Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anish Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Dr. Foss is joined by Dr. Demetrius Braddock. Dr. Braddock is associate professor of pathology at Yale School of Medicine, and he joins Dr. Foss for a conversation about hematopathology.
Let's start off by having you tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get interested in hematopathology?
Well, I think it had to do with, my teachers in medical school and, you know, my heroes, as it were, when I was training. So I trained at the University of Chicago, and at that time, and still today, there's a number of very eminent pathologists in the department who study the basic science of disease. And because Chicago is a very basic science kind of place, very similar to Yale, I was drawn to sort of the basic science of disease, and that led me naturally into pathology. So during my training, I actually did a PhD and an MD dual degree program, and my PhD was in the Department of Pathology in a lab that studied protein structure, so very basic kind of protein folding and protein design type questions.
We oftentimes don't interview pathologists on this show. It's mostly clinical doctors. Right. Can you just step backwards and give our audience a little bit of a background about pathologists, what you do as a hospital pathologist, and about the whole field of pathology and the kinds of research that are out there in that area?
Sure. So pathologists really are involved in the classification of disease, and it's evolved over the last century to become heavy involved in the classification of tumors of cancer. A pathologist's primary mission and job is to work with the treating physician, the oncologist or the infectious disease physician, to provide the correct classification of either the infection or the disease process, be it a tumor, infection, or viral illness that the patient is suffering from. The way the pathologist goes about giving that information is to look at tissue under a microscope, or now we look at tissue by looking at molecular tests and molecular diagnostic tests to give us a very detailed molecular analysis of the disease process that that we're facing with patients. So
pathology is really changing, as we're hearing more about molecular medicine. That's a part of what you're doing every day.
Absolutely. So pathology in general, and hematopathology in particular, is integrating the molecular signatures of tumors into the diagnosis. And so in hematopathology, for instance, we are very interested in combining in one single report a top-down analysis of the tumor from the way it appears under the microscope all the way down to the specific genetic mutations that that tumor has, in order to assist the treating physician in choosing targeted therapy that the patient may benefit from.
It sounds like there's now a lot of integration between the clinical part of a patient care and the pathological part, if we're talking about genes and pathways and drugs that we're using. Can you talk a little bit about that interaction and how that's actually changed, and what we're doing now, say, in the hematologic malignancy group at the Smilow Cancer Center?
Absolutely. So the integration of the clinical details is absolutely essential to provide the correct interpretation of a patient's disease. And, oftentimes we're on the phone with each other, or even sitting around a microscope together looking at the same tissue. And for example, I'm on service this week, and Nikolai was just down in the room with me as we were looking at a patient's bone marrow biopsy and trying to determine if this particular patient may be suffering a recurrence of his disease. And Nikolai was providing some clinical details for us to help us to help us interpret what we were seeing under the scope. So that process occurs on a daily basis with all the hem-onc attendings that are treating the patients and the hematopathologists working at SMILO. In addition, we have conferences throughout the week where we get together and we discuss in detail specific patients. And those conferences range from patients that have lymphomas. So there's a lymphoma conference where we focus on those patients with lymphomas that are problematic lymphomas. Maybe they haven't responded adequately to therapy. Maybe it was kind of a surprise diagnosis that we weren't expecting, and or a problem diagnosis that we can't seem to arrive at a conclusive answer for. And we'll sit around a big table. We'll look at the microscopic details of the tumor. We'll look at the radiologic findings, and we'll discuss the clinical presentation of the patients. And together we kind of come to a consensus about how we're going to proceed with that patient's treatment. That occurs also for leukemia patients who have blood-based malignancies. And we do the exact same sort of thing. And there's also now a coagulation conference where we discuss patients with bleeding disorders and bleeding diatheses or bleeding abnormalities that have presented. And Albert Lees is heading that effort, and he sees a number of these patients. And it's a very interesting conference. And Thomas Duffy, Dr. Duffy is also there in attendance, who's a wealth of knowledge and perspective on that disease process, as he's been at Yale for 30 some odd years and is nearing retirement, unfortunately, now. But you know, these people are invaluable, and they make Yale a very special place to be a physician at, as well as to be a patient being treated.
And I think from my side as a clinician, it's very, very important to patients that we have these conferences. And oftentimes we'll tell a patient, oh, we're presenting your pathology in our multimodality conference, and patients get very excited. Mm. And always remember to call me the day after or the day of the conference to get the results of that. So I think it's really important to patients to know that multiple eyes are going on their specimen and we're talking about it as a group.
Right. And I think as a patient, you know, who someone experienced with malignancy in my family, it's very comforting to know that there's many heads thinking about the best way forward in some of these complex and difficult diseases that really may not have clear answers yet. But when you're kind of right at the edge of what you can do and trying to push that edge, it makes all the difference to have all these people around the table.
I also wanted to touch on the fact that you probably see a lot of cases that don't actually come to Yale as a consultation service, since you have expertise in this area. Could you comment a little bit on your role in some of these external cases?
Sure. So in the hematopathology department, we see several different types of consults. One is consults brought in from an outreach effort that we have, where we've established a reference laboratory to do full molecular testing and workup of patients' tumors, and that effort's called Precipio Diagnostics. And we work with a number of oncologists throughout the country to provide a sort of a top-down integrated report of those patients' ailments. Diseases, usually they're leukemias and lymphomas. And again, there's a lot of phone consultation with those physicians, probably more than one would anticipate in a private practice setting. But often these physicians are out in the community practicing community medicine, but they want a academic level intensive workup of certain patients, so they'll send us that material.
So how does the community physician and how do patients out there in the community find out about this? And is this the right thing to do for every patient with a hematologic malignancy?
Yeah. It's primarily been by word of mouth, I think. You know, we're just getting it off the ground. It's been less than a year. The short answer is that, in general, oncologists treat patients And those patients can be very complicated, just like we see at the university. And you really have no idea when you're going to get a problem case, and you're going to need a higher level of workup than one would typically have available to them in the community. So in those cases, we offer services to assist the local pathologist or the local oncologist in the molecular analysis, as well as a review of the histology. Not every patient may need this level of care, but you know the billing is the exact same. There's no markup on these cases. They're just billed as a case typically would be. So there's no additional charge added. It's just that perhaps the level of analysis is at a greater detail. We also analyze solid tumors in this venture, and this is a tumor profiling panel that was put together by Jeff Sklar in the Department of Pathology on the molecular analysis of the tumors, and it tests for all of the oncogenes that are treatable. So either there's a clinical trial or there's a small molecule that is targeted against that specific mutation in the patient's tumor. And for patients with solid tumors that may have a targeted therapy, they can send us those tumors and we'll do this molecular analysis within a week, so trying to turn that case around such that the treating oncologist can initiate treatment of the patient with this targeted therapy in mind if the correct mutation is available.
So, Demetrius, that brings up an interesting point, and we've talked about it on the show, which is that we're not thinking about cancers as belonging to a specific organ site anymore, like lung or GI. We're starting to think more about these pathways from what we've learned from this kind of technique. Can you elaborate a little bit about that and where you think we're going in the future with that technology?
Certainly. I think that's an interesting observation. You know, in the past, historically, because we've graded cancers by the way they appear under a microscope, we've grouped tumors into lung tumors and colon tumors and the site of origin blood tumors. But now as we get into the molecular age where we've sequenced these cancers to the level where we can see that some of these cancers share the same mutations, and scientists and laboratories have developed very specific drugs that are very non-toxic, targeted against those specific mutations. Therefore, the way to approach these tumors isn't to think about them and treat them as if they belong to a certain site of origin, but to think about them as an abnormality or a tumor that has developed a mutation that can be treated effectively with a certain drug. So it's more of a treatment-based approach to cancer rather than a classification-based approach. So it's the treatment is driving the classification now, in a sense, and the science behind these tumors is driving their classification. So, for example, we've seen with incurable tumors, which would typically not respond to therapy, and the patient would undergo very toxic chemotherapy that would carry with it a lot of morbidity. Some of these tumors will occasionally, rarely, have a very specific mutation which we can target with one of these drugs, and the patient responds remarkably to this treatment. So for that reason, we're beginning to realize that our classification based on morphology is naive.
So I guess everything is changing in the future in the field of pathology.
That's right.
Yeah. We'll take a brief break now for a medical minute and stay tuned to learn more about hematopathology with Dr. Demetrius Braddock.
There are over 12 million cancer survivors in the U.S. right now, and the numbers keep growing. Completing treatment for cancer is a very exciting milestone, but cancer and its treatment can be a life-changing experience. The return to normal activities and relationships may be difficult, and cancer survivors may face other long-term side effects of cancer, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, and an increased risk of second cancers. Resources for cancer survivors are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale Cancer Center, to keep cancer survivors well and focused on healthy living. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined tonight by my guest, Dr. Demetrius Braddock. We're here today discussing the field of pathology and specifically hematopathology. We took a little tangent before the break to talk a little bit about molecular medicine and got into some fascinating topics about some of the new approaches in terms of identifying tissues and diseases based on genes that we've identified. And I know, Demetrius, that this probably leads into some of your research. Could you talk a little bit about some of the major projects that you're doing in the lab and how that segues into the whole field of pathology?
Sure. I'd love to do that. So, you know, my lab studies is very interested in sort of the basic science behind blood disorders and diseases. And recently, we've been studying a family of enzymes that really nobody's really looked at very closely. And there's one particular member of that family that was unclassified. So people knew it was out there because we've sequenced the human genome, so we know these proteins all exist. But nobody knew what its function was. And what researchers in my lab have been able to show over the last several years is we've been able to show the enzymatic function of this enzyme, that it cleaves a small molecule that is released by platelets. And the platelets release these molecules when they degranulate, so when they initiate clotting. And this enzyme exists on the surface, on the blood vessel surfaces of your brain, and it promotes blood clotting by taking the chemical released by the platelets and converting it into another molecule called adenosine diphosphate, or ADP. And ADP strongly stimulates platelet aggregation. People have known that these small molecules were in platelets for 30 years, but they've never really understood why they were there and why they were released. And so it was a little bit gratifying to describe the enzyme that's on the blood vessel surfaces that can actually take that small molecule and make it into something that makes sense in the clotting reaction for us.
Do you see that being implemented in the clinic in any way, and how can it help us to treat patients who are developing clots?
Sure. So, the exciting thing about this finding is that it's very localized to the brain. So we haven't seen the enzyme on the surface of other blood vessels in the periphery, in the heart or the lungs or any of the other tissues we've looked at. And so we're really thinking that this may be important for helping us treat strokes, where patients will develop blood clots in their brain and clot off arteries and cause these terrible problems that occur during stroke. So part of the difficulty treating patients that clot is over-treating them, and they will bleed, and they'll bleed from sites other than the site that you're trying to prevent bleeding. But because this is a very localized enzyme to the brain, and we can target it specifically during the platelet aggregation phase of the clotting. So, in other words, when we target the bleeding, we're not indiscriminately targeting all bleeding. We're just targeting bleeding at the site of platelet degranulation. So it's a very specific and anatomical location, and it's a very physiologically specific to the site of platelet degranulation. So we're hoping that we can take advantage of these two two characteristics of the finding to specifically improve the treatment of stroke.
That sounds really fascinating. And that dovetails into the coagulation conference you talked about. And I just wanted to not pass by that because I think it's an important point for the audience as well. Can you talk just a few minutes about like clotting problems in general and what the new advances are in that field?
Sure. You know, often patients present with clotting problems and they're not aware of them. And they may have a genetic predisposition for clotting. They may inherit mutations in certain proteins like von Willebrand factor and other enzymes that are involved in coagulation, and not know of them. And it's only during pregnancy or perhaps during a elective surgery that the patient bleeds indiscriminately or unexpectedly or clots unexpectedly and there's a problem. And to prevent future issues regarding future pregnancies or future surgeries, we work these patients up quite intensely. And these are done in a combined conference, as we've discussed, with both clinical pathologists, hematopathologists, and the treating hematologists that that take care of these patients. And we kind of get into the genetics of their disease. We'll go into sequencing. We'll do specific clinical tests to determine the exact sites of the bleeding abnormalities, whether they're in the platelets themselves or they're in the clotting cascade, the intrinsic or extrinsic clotting cascades. But we'll try and isolate the exact problem, then we'll try and determine it genetically and develop a treatment plan around the exact classification of that disease.
One question that the audience may have is, if you have a clotting problem, is it always genetic? Do you need a genetic test? Does everybody out there who has a clotting problem or a bleeding problem need a genetic test?
Yeah, and so the answer is no. Sometimes we can just treat the patient presumptively based on their clinical findings and not need to resort to that level of detail. There are other patients with clotting problems for which there is no genetic test available. And, you know, again, those patients need to be treated on a presumptive basis. But these treatments are very effective in treating and taking care of their problems. So that's why we do it.
And I understand that there aren't many hospitals that actually have these clotting clinics that you're talking about in the clotting conferences.
Yeah, it's a fairly specialized branch of medicine, and it takes a whole group of highly trained and highly experienced physicians to be able to quickly diagnose and treat these patients. I think it's a more subtle type of presentation and illness than most even large medical centers are able to field.
And the kind of assays that you need to do and some of the tests that you need to do are fairly sophisticated. Are they available in many medical centers, or is there a limitation as far as where those tests can get done?
Yeah, the equipment, this is another area that's evolving quickly, and the equipment and the way we measure platelet aggregation and interactions between the platelets and the vessels' walls is clinically changing with our knowledge of science. So the assays that are out there are very new and they're quite expensive, and so often community hospitals won't be able to invest the money in these very highly specialized tests for which only a very few number of patients will use during a typical year. But at the university, these tests are available, and the hospital has invested in these tests so that we can accurately diagnose and treat these patients.
As if that wasn't enough in the lab, I understand you're doing a number of other projects that are exciting. You have a chemokine project and a project with microRNA. Can you give us some information about both of those?
Sure. So both of these projects are with Yale researchers that I'm assisting on, and they both involve a lymphoma treatment. So the chemokine project is an interesting project because it's involved in the structures of these G-coupled protein receptors, which exist on cell surfaces. And the Nobel Prize actually in chemistry was awarded this year to an individual who first described the structure of these proteins after many, many years of failure. And a lot of work and effort went into this remarkable discovery. But now we know the structures of these G-coupled protein receptors, And there's several of them that are specific for T-cell lymphomas, which is your area of expertise, Dr. Foss. And so we're working together with a structural biologist here at Yale, Elias Lolis, on actually determining the structure of these G-coupled protein receptors that are present in T-cell lymphomas. We're hopeful that combined with small molecule screening and our ability to make large quantities of these proteins, we'll be able to screen these proteins through the Yale Small Molecule Discovery Center, develop new inhibitors, and then with your database of patients with T-cell lymphomas and your interaction with these patients, we'll be able to actually measure the clinical effect of some of these drugs in cell-based assays. So that's the long-term hope of that proposal. But again, it starts out from a very basic science perspective where we're going to start from the structure, develop inhibitors, and then move into the clinic.
So this is really translational medicine at its best, bench to bedside?
Exactly. That's the hope, is that we can start from, you know, a strong foundation of really knowing the way these proteins look and how they work, and then move into the unknown, which is what they do in these incurable T-cell lymphomas.
So once you learn something from this particular one, will you be able to extrapolate that to, say, other G protein-coupled receptors in this process of screening small molecules? Will we learn something from this that can be extrapolated to other kinds of cancer?
Absolutely. So the G-coupled protein receptors are very important for a number of cancers. And in fact, I think pharmacologically they're the most drugged protein out there. And so we know starting out that it's very easy, or it's very possible, I should say, not easy, but it's very possible to develop small molecule drugs that effectively inhibit these proteins. So that's why we're very interested in going after this approach. The second thing that we're taking advantage of is that these diseases are currently incurable. So the patients that have them eventually will succumb to their disease, and there is no effective treatment. So something needs to be tried that is a little bit out of the box and a little bit drastic, if you will. And so we're hopeful that we can start from really the first principles of the process, the signaling receptors on these T-cell lymphomas, and arrive at effective treatments that will be non-toxic. And if we're able to do that, then we can extend into other types of cancers and lymphomas with the same family of receptors.
What about the other project that I guess we're both involved in, which is another way of really trying to develop a model system to study another rare type of lymphoma? Can you talk a little bit about that and some of the technology that's gone into that?
Sure.
That particular project?
Love to. So this is a model that was developed by Frank Slack in the Department of Cell Biology at Yale. And what Frank has done is he's induced microRNA, a specific microRNA called 155, which we know has been associated with B-cell lymphomas for a while. And he's made a transgenic mouse that overexpresses this microRNA. And he originally was anticipating that these mice would develop brain tumors. And so, as often happens in science, what you anticipate happens is not going to happen, but something even more important happened. And that was that these mice instead developed lymphomas. And although maybe he was a little bit upset about it at first, it turns out to be very important, because the kind of lymphomas these mice develop are called double-hit lymphomas. These are a type of lymphoma in which the BCL2 protein as well as the c-Myc oncogene are both misregulated. These lymphomas respond very poorly to treatment, and there is no good model system on how we are going to develop new treatments. So what Frank has right now in his hands is a perfect model system for the development of new therapies for a very rare and incurable type of lymphoma. And that's an area of interest that we're both involved in and hopefully we'll be able to work forward with.
Dr. Demetrius Braddock is Associate Professor of Pathology at Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or comments, we invite you to visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of previously broadcast episodes. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.